A huge shout out to our amazing lifetime patrons for this Registry Matters episode. The show simply wouldn't be the same without the incredible support from Justin, Brian, Michael, Mark, and Andrew. You rock our podcasting world, guys.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 345, probably the temperature where you are right now. This is Registry Matters. Larry, how are you tonight?
Nice and toasty.
I bet it is. Are you in the triple digits? Obviously you are.
No, actually today it only hit 98.
98. And 2% humidity, of course?
Oh, I think it's around 10%.
People here, it's in the upper 80s, low 90s, and it's, you know, comparatively, what is it, 40%? And people are like, oh my God, it's so hot. They're going to die. It's amazing. It's amazing how much they're bitching about it. I spent a bunch of time, I lived in New Orleans for like 6 or so years. And down there, you got to break out a knife, a machete, when you're leaving out of the house in the morning to cut through the air to get to your car.
Well, it's not too much different in Georgia, is it really? Because that's subtropical as well, but I guess
it's
on the coastline.
It's significant. It is significant. It is incredibly humid in Georgia, I promise. But oh my God, it is an order of magnitude worse than Louisiana, down there in New Orleans. It's bad. Thick.
Well, the Omni Coliseum that they built in opened in 1973, one of the reasons why they had to replace it is because the subtropical climate rusted out some of the important structure support.
Right. Seems reasonable. Seems reasonable. Well, please make sure that you press like, subscribe, notification bell, leave a 5-star review. You know the drill. It helps us out. Helps us find new listeners that might be, you know, listed as terrorist organizations, that way they could find us too. Does that sound like a good plan, Larry?
Sounds like a fabulous plan.
And anyway, so what are we doing tonight? I'm sure this is going to be an interesting show.
Well, it is. Chance is unable to join us this week due to being sick with the flu, and he actually is very sick. I could barely understand him yesterday. This means it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom.
You are very good at this, by the way.
What, being doom and gloom?
Yes.
Well, tonight we're going to have some positive news. We have a case from the New York Court of Appeals, which is actually the high court, kind of like that wacky state of Maryland where they call their highest court their Court of Appeals. And that is actually a win for PFRs. Also, we plan to do a segment on the NARSL conference, which was scheduled to kick off on Friday, June 27th. We have two questions from an incarcerated PFR in federal custody. I think that's about enough for this week, don't you?
Probably. Well, let's dump right into Christopher's questions. And says, my question for the legal corner is a tough one. And I sent the question to you about 5 years ago after pondering over it with a group of my peers at FMC Devins. Please translate.
What do you mean? That's the name of the institution. What am I translating?
FMC. Oh, I can come up with a lot of really not very nice ways to say FMC.
Federal Medical Center.
Ah, and Devins, where is this going to be located?
It's up in the state of Texas.
Oh, okay. All right. And it has to do with sentencing and the registry. It is why, as we as Americans practice common law, there is such a vast difference in outcomes for the same crimes broken? And it says, I find all states follow different guidelines for sentencing for a crime, as well as the feds follow a much stiffer sentence guide than the states. I daily see a repeat offender get far less for identical crimes like trading underage inappropriate images. Mind you, the state perp traded with a neighbor, and the fed perp was triggered by the National Child Abduction and Abuse Center and use a device made in China, yet one gets probation, where a fed gets 60 months. And I think that's the end of that one.
That sounds like the end of that one, yes.
Okay, that's a question, but I can ponder one in there. Why are they so different?
That's the question. And the answer is somewhat complicated, but also somewhat simple. The federal government is a separate sovereign from the states. We run a system of federalism where there are federal crimes and there are state crimes. And that confuses people a lot because they assume that since the federal, in the hierarchy, the federal government is higher, that everything should be prosecuted federally. Like the people that complain and complain about the protesters after George Floyd, and they didn't get harshly treated because they were tearing up buildings and stuff in Washington and Oregon and Minneapolis. Remember that?
Yep.
Well, but there was no federal jurisdictional hook. So the feds just can't come in and scoop up people and prosecute them. Or at least they couldn't until this administration took power, but maybe they can now. But there's a separate and solely completely different sovereign. Well, the United States, after electing Ronald Reagan in 1980, decided that the federal sentencing was too lenient. And prior to 1984, we had a system where people, if they were sentenced federally, could be released on parole. And I forget what the ratio was, 20%, 25%. It escapes my memory because it's been decades ago, but they would be eligible for parole. And the U.S. Parole Commission granted parole to a lot of folks. But also there were no sentencing guidelines, which meant that a federal judge had really carte blanche from supervised probation, unsupervised probation, to a term of incarceration that would be fairly harsh for the same crimes. And the conservative side of the aisle decided that that was too much of a checkerboard. It was one sovereign, the United States, and they didn't understand why in the state of Alabama, if you did crime A, you're going to go to the federal penitentiary. And in the state of California, you did crime A, the same crime, you could get probation. And these lifetime appointed federal judges under Article 3 needed to be held accountable. So they did the Sentencing Reform Act, and they mandated practically everybody go to prison. Probation is very rare in the federal system anymore. Has been for decades, not just anymore. And I mean, you could take a look at Martha Stewart. Remember her heinous crime? Do you remember what she did?
She did something where someone told her to, this stock is probably not going to do well, and she sold it. So then she did some number of months for insider trading.
Yes, and then ultimately the stock would have made money if she'd have held it. But for a very white-collar economic crime where there was no real harm done to the community, she had to go to the federal pen. And that was a result of the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. So Christopher and all your friends up there at the FMC, you can ask yourself this question. Why did the voters of the United States elect President Reagan? And why did they elect a conservative landslide in 1980? This is a direct reflection of what we the people wanted then. And it's a direct reflection of what we the people want now at a federal level. We want people to suffer in prison. And we the people can change this. But we the people had a choice in 2017 or 2018, I forget which year it was, when the first STEP Act was passed. And we the people elected a number of very conservative senators, particularly one named Tom Cotton from Arkansas, but others, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, a group of six or eight conservative senators, and they gutted the first STEP Act. So Christopher, ask the friends there at the prison, why do we the people keep voting for these people that continue to want extremely harsh sentences? And why we the people vote against and vilify people who talk about reducing prison population and alternatives? Because the reason why the federal system is so tough is because as a nation, we want it that way. We the people have done no intervention for 40 years, meaningful intervention, except for the slight improvement that the First Step Act took. So it reflects back to us, Christopher.
Do you think, I'm trying to think of a way to word this, to what do you think the system, the country would look like as a whole, as if we had, and this wouldn't just apply to like legal stuff, this would apply to taxes, this would apply to speed limits, if we had a unified set, top down, here are the laws, and all 340 million of us are going to be guided by those laws.
I'm not understanding the question. Are you saying
I'm just trying to, can you imagine what that would be like?
Well, would that mean that we would abolish the states and everything would
Right?
go into a unitary system like the Canadians have and like the British Crown? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I guess I hadn't really thought it through like that. So yeah, we would just be, we are in the state of the United States. That's our state. Where are you from? There, the state.
So, well, as I understand, the Canadian and the British system haven't lived in either country, but as I understand it, that's the way they operate. If you're in Canada, you commit a crime, it's a crime against Canada, and they can move you from one province to the other. There's no real formal extradition because it's all one sovereign. But in the United States, if you get charged federally, that is one sovereign. But if you get charged under state law, then they have to extradite you because the sovereign state of Georgia can't send its troops into the sovereign state of Idaho to snatch someone.
Another way that I think about it is just the framing of a statement that each state is an experiment on democracy, and then you could go, well, which one seems to be working better? Well, we should model ourselves after that one. And that's what we do. So you see that, oh, these really, 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 really bad PFR crime sentences in this state, oh, we should mirror them and we should outdo them. And they all try to race to the bottom to see who can be the worstest.
That is, and that's in part two of the next question from Christopher.
Oh,
But
so I stepped ahead.
the issue here is, until we as a nation make it plainly apparent by who we vote for, if we continue to vote for Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and on down the list, I don't want to spend the whole podcast naming people, but if we keep doing that, Marjorie Taylor Greene, we're going to continue to have this harshness. And I don't want to criticize the president, but I will say that the president has promised law and order and to treat criminals very harshly. But yet he is very popular with people who are behind bars. Go figure. But prior to the Sentencing Reform Act, you heard this at a presentation I did at a NARSOL conference. The Federal Bureau of Prisons housed roughly 20,000 people in 1980. It had housed roughly 20,000, give or take 1,000 or so, for the 40 years leading up to 1980. By the time Mr. Reagan left office, now remember the Sentencing Reform Act only passed in 84. By the time he left office in 88, the Bureau of Prisons, where they had been stagnant for 40 years, he left office with roughly 57,000 prisoners in custody.
Did you say 20 something to start that?
Roughly 20,000. It would bob around between 18 to 22,000.
So it nearly tripled?
It nearly tripled by the end of the Reagan administration.
Damn, that's a lot of folks.
Well, then it continued to go up and up all through the successive administrations because these laws were permanent. They didn't leave with the Reagan administration. So by the time Obama got into office, we were over 200,000 federal prisoners. And then there were some modest reductions that started under Obama. And actually, to my surprise, they continued under Trump. The federal prison population has backed off a little bit, but we're still many times where we above where we were when Ronald Reagan was elected. The 40-year stagnation of 18 to 22,000 has leveled off now, I think, at about 185,000.
A lot of folks. All right, so question number two. I also see a vast difference with the laws that govern each state's registry. I ask first to why is there such a difference? And second, is there anything we could do to tackle these differences so that something more harsh does not become a new common norm? It just seems to be a system without any articulated agreement on what one guy who did this particular crime gets this, whereas another guy who does the same thing just gets probation and does not have to register. I do know money, and also if you bring something of value to the table, often changes the outcome greatly. But Larry, why is the such vast, God, that's written poorly. But Larry, why is there such a vast difference? And is there anything I could do to protect myself from putting myself into a situation that may cost me due to very harsh laws and sentences?
Well, the answer to that is not as complicated as it might seem. Again, we're 50 separate sovereigns, and the states are free to make their own laws in terms of the registry. Now, this same person, I don't know philosophically which way this person leans, but that same person, if they lean conservative, they would decry and find it appalling that the big old bad federal government would tell the states what their laws should be. But magically, when it comes to the registry, I hear a lot of clamoring for that there should be a federal registry guideline that no state could exceed. And that seems to be somewhat contradictory. If we think that the states know best, why would we want to have the federal government usurp the state power, if you're a true conservative and believer in states' rights, and try to impose on them the ceilings of what they can do in terms of registration? Now, they have imposed a floor of what you can do if you want to have a federally compliant funded registry, but you don't have to have a registry at all. Any state could abolish their registry tomorrow, and it wouldn't be anything the federal government could do about it. And stay tuned, because we're going to have a case where we're talking about from the highest court of New York, where they actually say that very thing. But there's the registry is driven by fear, and some states are, they have a lot stronger advocates from the victim side, from law enforcement side, and the people are a lot more susceptible to the fear tactics. You take an average Vermont voter where the registry is not so bad, and you compare that to an average Alabama voter. If you were to take a IQ test,
okay,
the average voter in the educational achievement level in Vermont is quite a bit higher than it is in Alabama.
Correct.
That's how you have Kay Ivey governing the state of Alabama. What have I said about the state of Alabama? You might have a little clip to play about that. It's run by.
Run by the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
Wow, that was loud. Let me turn that thing down. Sorry.
The states get to make their own laws in terms of what offenses that they register and how long they register them and what the penalties are for noncompliance. And there's really nothing we can do about it in our system, because each state has that right to do that. But his other part of the question was, what can we do about it? Well, what we can do about it is very difficult. We could have what's called a uniform law between the states. And that's something that we have a lot of uniform laws. They're similar to treaties where you pass a uniform law, and then the states, each legislative body adopts the uniform law, and so they're all on the same page. And I think I've used this example before, like mobile home titles, making them real property so that you can borrow against them in a traditional banking setting. Many of the states, if not all of them, have adopted a uniform law about that, where they can be treated as real property. So if you take your mobile home from a state that has adopted the uniform law to another state, it would qualify as real property. But all the nuances are somewhat complicated, because you have to put it on a foundation and there's all these things, and it makes it more difficult to move a mobile home. But theoretically, if you could move it, it would still be real property if you got it to another state. But we're so far into the registry scheme, we're decades into what we're doing now. The original federal Jacob Wetterling Act passed in 1994. Well, I mean, you do the math. Where are we? We're, what, 30 years from then?
Yeah.
So we've got 30 years of this system. And people depend on making their money in this system as it exists today. And when I say people, I'm talking about the apparatus that runs it. Your sheriff's departments in most jurisdictions, and it's usually law enforcement, if it's not the sheriff, it's the police department or a combination of the two. Those people are getting funding. And in the pure wind-driven state of Maryland, I think they get like $250 a year to track each offender as a part of the state law, which is very nice for the law enforcement apparatus. But I would tend to think that in Maryland, since they're getting $250 per offender, it would be very difficult to convince them to want to do it any differently, because they would see revenue leaving their department, right?
Oh, that is right.
So you would have a hard time pulling it away from law enforcement, because a lot of budgetary money, you know, a lot of budget outlay would go with it. So in terms of what we do about it, education, litigation is the primary part of the stool. Of if we can educate the public that the registry doesn't work and convince people of that, and if we can continue to litigate successfully and chip away at what the registry is allowed to do, we might put caps on it through judicial intervention. like maybe someday, no state can list your home address because of the risk is real. The document, the documented incidents of abuse and even murder are plentiful. I don't even know if there's a catalog of how many, but they're quite common and regular. So there might be enough judicial intervention if we ever do a case one of these days where we don't file a motion for summary judgment and refuse to develop an evidentiary record and don't have good, credible witnesses, and we don't call witnesses that testify in opposite to what we're arguing. If we don't do stuff like that, if we actually learn how to litigate, we might win more cases, and we might be able to put the brakes and boundaries around the registry. And then through carefully vetting candidates that we vote for and consider carefully if they say that they want everybody to do hard time in prison for the rest of their life, take them seriously and don't vote for them if that's one of your priorities, if it's a significant priority to you. But I know that, see, people always inform me that they have to look at the big picture, you understand?
So I know. I've heard
they don't. Yeah, of course, they insult us and say that we don't look at the big picture, because I look at the big picture, probably bigger picture than most everybody else looks at. But if we continue to vote for the people who promise to be tough on offenders, in particular sexual type offenders, we shouldn't be shocked when they continue to be tough.
I understand. God, you know, I had a question in there that I wanted to ask you, but you kept going and I could never inject it in there. But it's all good.
Well, we can hang around with this, because I really like his questions, and I don't mean to be an a-hole about it, but it all reflects back to we the people.
It does. I agree. And the we the people of the 1 million or, you know, 750, whatever that number is, have up to this point been less than effective at changing what it is from the past to make it something better now and in the future.
I certainly agree with that. And
do you know, I have a proverb for you. When's the best time to plant a tree?
No idea.
20 years ago. When's the second best time to plant a tree?
19 years ago.
Today.
But we the people continue to do this, voting against our interest. And then we're shocked when the logical outcome flows from how we voted. And it's not all that complicated, folks. If you want criminal justice reform, don't vote for Josh Hawley. Don't vote for what's the guy's Arkansas that I rag on all the time?
Arkansas.
Yeah, the center that led the charge was got the first step back was from Arkansas.
Tom Cotton, Jim Jordan.
Tom Cotton.
Jim Jordan.
Tom Cotton.
Tom Cotton. Okay.
Okay. So if you keep voting for those people, don't be shocked. You keep getting the same thing. You keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same result. And that's what we've been doing over and over again. An overwhelming number of our population and of people we try to serve vote completely contrary to their interests when it comes to this stuff.
Well, let's move along to this New York case that I have no idea how we're going to work through this, because I don't have anything to talk about. Oh, I guess it would. Never mind. Sorry. I thought that this was moved down. Never mind. I'm going to shut up. Hey, I'm going to read, Larry. Is that okay?
Yes.
You have this case from New York that you wanted to pontificate about. It's the People versus Sherlock. I have to just say it, Larry. Holmes. Laugh track. Anything? Can you chuckle? Nothing?
Well, because I didn't see the Holmes there. Was that Sherlock or Sherlock Holmes?
It will be Sherlock Holmes. It's Sherlock. It's Sherlock without the Holmes. I was trying to make a funny, and never mind. All right. Anyway, so it's the People versus Sherlock, decided on May 15th by the New York Court of Appeals. And I, during my day, while I was cutting the grass today, Larry, I had a book on the lawnmower, and I read it numerous times. And I know where you're headed, but I'm betting you want to focus on the Federal Registry.
Focus on what?
The federal, say it with me, like Federal Registry. People think, everyone knows there's a Federal Registry. Why can you not admit that?
I can't admit it because a Federal Registry does not exist.
Obviously it does, Larry. But with that, our separate pieces of information here. The defendant, Daniel Sherlock, had been convicted of possession of CP under federal law. Sherlock appealed from an order of the county court, Suffolk County, designated him as a level 2 sexually violent offender pursuant to PFR Registration Act, which is also known as SORA. The appellate division affirmed the Suffolk County judge in 224-AD-3rd-709. I don't know what that means. And then Sherlock appealed. So how's that?
That's fantastic. Keep going.
No. It doesn't work that way. It is your job. You're going to tell us what the issues are that are on appeal.
Well, the primary issue on this appeal is whether defendant Sherlock was properly designated as a sexually violent offender under the correction law that you just cited. New York's SORA defines three circumstances under which such a designation is appropriate. Relevant to this case is the third circumstance, where a defendant stands convicted of a felony in any other jurisdiction for which the offender is required to register as in the jurisdiction which it occurred. That doesn't seem right. But anyway, you have to be required to register in a jurisdiction where it occurred.
All right. Well, then I will provide some details since I read it so many times while I was cutting the grass. And this was a push mower, mind you. Sherlock was convicted in federal court of possession of prawn. Prior to his release from federal prison, a SORA risk assessment hearing was held in county court. In anticipation of the hearing, the Board of Examiners of Sex Offenders prepared a risk assessment instrument which presumptively designated the defendant a level 1 offender, which of course is the lowest risk classification. The Board of Examiners made no recommendation with respect to the defendant's designation as a sexually violent offender. The People, which is New York in this case, prepared their own risk assessment instrument designating the defendant as a presumptive level 2 PFR, assessing additional points for both the number and age of the defendant's victims as well as defendant's lack of relationship with any of the victims. The People further requested that the court designate Sherlock as a sexually violent offender pursuant to correction law subsection 168-A based on his conviction in federal court under the federal criminal statute. This is not right. The People intervened to undermine the PFR Board of Examiners.
I agree. They just can't help themselves, though. When the People, that means the prosecution apparatus, when they don't like the outcome, they look for ways to circumvent it. So they just can't help it.
So how do they justify their intervention?
In support of their risk level assessment, the People presented evidence in the form of an investigatory report indicating that Sherlock possessed a total of 86 child prawn images, 40 which were from the Tweety series. I have no idea what that is.
I have no idea what that is either.
A collection of images depicting three children ranging in age from 8 to 14 years of age in a variety of sexual and sexualized contexts. Sherlock was also in possession of 11 child prawn images depicting another named victim, as well as 35 prawn images depicting unidentified child victims. The report also explained that the defendant's computer contained evidence of recently deleted files with names suggesting that they contained additional prawn content depicting children, with one such file strongly indicating that the subject was 8 years old. Now, I don't know about what they're talking about here. That's over my head. If you delete files, I don't know how you can tell what was in the files. Maybe you can enlighten me on that, but that's what they said.
If you want me to, when you delete a file, the file doesn't get deleted. That's your first challenge. So there's a kind of like this, Larry, if you went into the library, if you've ever been to a library, and nobody recently has, I don't think my kid's ever been to a library, to be honest with you. And if you just took the card catalog entry out, the book's still on the shelf, right?
I would agree with that.
So when you delete a file, that's what essentially happens, is you just take the reference to it out, and then the space can just be overwritten when the next time it comes around. So you have to explicitly go and tell things to then go wipe that data area multiple times over. Because even if you write over it once, you can still get the data back.
I see. All right.
Send you.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
So what did the court ultimately say?
They said, quote, a plain reading of the statutory language and application of our precedent in this area established that defendant was not required to register as a PFR in the jurisdiction in which his conviction occurred and therefore was improperly designated as sexually violent, end of quote.
The appellate division unanimously affirmed, holding that the defendant was properly designated a sexually violent offender under New York correction law. How was the issue framed differently for the Court of Appeals then?
Well, they focused on the foreign registration clause of that correction law that you referred to earlier, which defines a sexually violent offense as one based on a conviction of a felony in any other jurisdiction for which the offender is required to register as a PFR in the jurisdiction which the conviction occurred. In this case, the jurisdiction was in federal court. And as I've always stated, there's no federal registry, so therefore he was not required to register in that jurisdiction.
Now, the decision states, we recently recognized that this statute is problematic in that it imposes higher burdens on nonviolent PFRs convicted in a foreign jurisdiction relative to the defendants convicted in similar offenses in New York. They cited People versus Taluto, and that's 39 New York 3rd 306. And from 2022. Nonetheless, we held in Taluto that because the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous, it must be applied to PFRs convicted in foreign jurisdictions according to its terms. See Taluto at 314 and 315. Now, how did they square that holding in Taluto with the present case with Mr. Sherlock?
Well, they did it very carefully. They said applying the clear and unambiguous statutory language in this case, defendant cannot be designated as sexually violent because he was not required to register as a PFR in the jurisdiction which the conviction occurred. And I'm reading, continuing from them, this is because the federal government does not maintain a PFR registry of the sort that states are required to operate by the federal mandate. Although the federal government maintains two sex offender databases, the information contained in them merely represents a collection of registration information acquired from registries maintained by individual state and territorial jurisdictions. And they cite U.S. Code 34 U.S. Code 20921 and 20922. Further, although federal law requires PFRs convicted of federal sex offenses to register in each jurisdiction where they work, live, or go to school, significantly for purposes of this statutory scheme, the law defines jurisdiction as a state or territory and contains no requirement that federally convicted PFRs must register with the federal government.
Interesting. And then what are your final thoughts on this? Because, it's about time for us to move on.
Well, my final thoughts are I'm gratified to know that the highest tribunal in the state of New York listens to Registry Matters podcast. And they follow my legal doctrine. We've been doing this pretty often lately where cases basically verbatim say what I say. They agree and held that there's no federal registry. Now, this can be fixed. The New York Assembly will fix this. And they'll broaden the language to include those federal convictions. But to their credit, they're following textualism, which amazingly I'm in favor of in this case.
And also, this is a pointy-headed state.
Yes, but amazingly, they're following the text because they wanted to come to this outcome. But this will likely be fixed in the legislature fairly quickly. If they're in session year-round, it may be fixed this year, but they'll fix this. They're not going to let federally convicted PFRs not have to register. And that's what this essentially says. If you're convicted of federal PFR, as a PFR, you don't have to register. There's no way they can let this stand. But it's important to note, folks, that there is no federal registry. There's a federal recommendation to the states. If you want money from us, if you really want it, this is what you have to do to get it. And these are the minimum guidelines you have to meet to get it. And you have to do X number universe of sex offenses. And you have to register those people for X number of years, depending on the type of offense it is. And you have to share certain information across the land and on. But no state has to do any of that stuff. They could flip the middle finger, shut out the lights tomorrow, and there would be nothing the federal government could do about it. Nothing. And no state's going to do that. Yeah, we had a few years ago, the state of people in Oregon said they were getting ready to take down the registry because they were convinced that they were going to build the public support. And I just did the Clinton laugh because I said, how on earth do you actually believe that you're going to open up the state of Oregon to all the PFRs from the whole United States that have the mobility to move to Oregon? I mean, nobody in Oregon is going to be stupid enough to vote for something like that. But they
could if they wanted
to. And it's their hell-bent desire to get federal funds that causes them to do this stuff. But they're not required to. And therefore, the federal government would just have to take it in the chin if they decided not to have a registry. And another thing that they do is they register people for far longer than what's required by federal law, you know, for it to be substantially compliant. You don't have to register everybody for life. See, Mississippi does, Alabama does, Florida does, Texas does, on and on. They've registered people for life. They don't have to register child. They do have to register child porn, but they don't have to register indecent exposure. That's not in the targeted offenses. But I think every state, in some way or fashion, registers indecent exposure. It may be for a second or third offense. It may be for exposing yourself to a minor. But they, all the states that I've checked their registry, they have something on there that's not even required. There's no proximity restrictions. There's no work restrictions. All the things that you gripe about that makes you so mad about the registry, they have nothing to do with the Adam Walsh Act or the federal government.
You know, I had another question. So do they get money from, so a state that puts people on there for life, that counts as a person on their roster, so then they turn that in to the feds and then they get a check for someone that's been on the registry for 60 years, even though the feds don't require that you have somebody on there for 60 years?
My understanding is not quite that way. They don't get money per se for a registrant being on the registry. They get money for things like technical help and for compliance monitoring of offenders. Well, let's just do the math here. If you put everybody in lifetime, since death is the only thing that takes you off, that would mean you would get more compliance money. But they don't just like tally up and say, oh, you've got this many registrants, we're sending you a check for this amount of money.
That's kind of what I was ultimately asking.
Yeah. Well, but now Maryland does do that. You know, at the state of Maryland, they do that. It's directly geared to, unless they've changed the law, each law enforcement unit that tracks a particular number of offenders, they get a particular number of dollars for each offender that they're tracking. So they're slightly different in Maryland, but I don't know of any other state that does it that way.
Do you have any feeling of Team Blue, Team Red, which ones, I think the answer is already there, that they don't put all of PFRs in the worst kind of categories, so therefore they receive less money, but the red states are the ones that say they want to cut back on the federal government handing out all this money, but they're the ones that are collecting more of it for PFRs?
You kind of nailed that, and for a person who doesn't hang out at capitals, you nailed it really, really well.
That's interesting.
The people who profess that the government is so big and too large and too bloated, if you watch them in action in their state legislative chambers, they will constantly say, we have to enact this law, whatever it is. It's not just PFR stuff. It's domestic violence, DWI, different things that the feds don't have a jurisdictional hook and they want the states to do certain things. They say, oh, well, we got to do that to get the federal money. And I say, well, wait. You say that the federal government is spending too much money, and yet you're enacting laws to get more money from the government that you say is spending too much that you want to see spending less. Do I have that right? And they roll their eyes, they refuse to answer you, and they ignore you when you ask the question. So we've got some conservative listeners. Please explain that to us. We'll open the microphone to you next week after, whenever you can come up with an explanation. Why is it that you claim you want the government to be smaller at the federal level, and then you do everything you can to get every single federal dollar to get flow into your state while you're at the same time pontificating about how the federal government spends too much money?
Interesting. Well, very well. I think that answers all of my questions. All right. Shall we move along?
I suppose so.
All right. I see that you put, I believe this is a YouTube clip. I did not cue it. Am I playing this?
No,
it's just a link to a webpage. Never mind. I thought it was going to be
YouTube. This is an old article from the Christian Science Monitor. Well, I don't even know if they're in publication anymore.
I believe they are.
You think they actually print the monitor like they used to? I can't imagine they would actually print a paper.
As of 10 years ago, they did. And I saw them in prison.
I see.
All right. Well, then, so what do you want me to do here? Is this for you to cover, or do you want me to read this?
No, I was going to rebut you with this. This is, we were going to talk about the NARSL conference. And,
yep.
And unfortunately, the NARSL conference was canceled by the hotel. And it's been quite devastating to NARSL, to the team. And so I just wanted to pontificate that this is not anything new. You know, this has been going on for years. And I have been griping about it for years. I haven't pretended like it just happened. I have been very unhappy about people trying to shut down speech. Now, let me clarify, you don't have a right to speak at someone else's platform. So this conference is ours, and you don't have any right to speak there. But if we are trying to speak at our event, you also have no right to shut us down and to silence us. And that's what people are trying to do. And this, the most blatant, flagrant example I remember, I was quite young, but in 1983, we had a United Nations ambassador named Jean Kirkpatrick. And Ms. Kirkpatrick was prevented from speaking in 1983 by a bunch of hecklers at UCLA Berkeley. And UCLA Berkeley is supposed to be the bastion of forward thinking. And in 1964, they were the bastion that said that free speech was so important that on college campi that they should be able to speak without any interruption from the administration and anti-war protests and all that kind of stuff. They were all for free speech. But magically, less than 20 years later, they took a whole different view. And Ms. Kirkpatrick was heckled and shouted down to the point that she had to cancel her speech that she had been invited to do for the university. And University of California Chancellor Ira Heyman said he was embarrassed that Berkeley had been advertised around the world as the place that succumbed to mob rule. And that is what I'm seeing here, is that this hotel succumbed to mob rule. And after a 56-11 academic Senate vote, on a rather mild resolution, Dr. Heyman said he was considering how incidents like that could be avoided. And one suggestion has been to have controversial speakers appear before invitation-only audience. And Mr. Heyman pledged to use every reasonable means to ensure that future visitors to the campus are treated with dignity. Well, I am still incensed by what happened. Our whole team is demoralized by what happened. And this is not the America that I thought that I grew up in, where we respected people who have different views. I would defend any group that wants to protest peacefully. I don't care if it's the KKK. I would defend their right as long as they're peacefully expressing their opinion. That doesn't mean I support the KKK at all. But Proud Boys, you're out of line. And that's who was our problem. Okay, so I've pontificated enough.
Well, my question to you is, how is that? So you brought up something from the 80s then, but how is that different than, say, like the civil rights movement, where back in the day there were mostly blacks were marching all over, mostly in the South. But then there were counter protests of mostly whites, intimidating, threatening, and even doing things like killing people, killing blacks and interracial couples. How's that all, like, you're talking about this event at a university of a person being shut down, like that's 20 and 30 years prior to that, and potentially even still much, much later that was going on?
Well, I don't guess I'm completely understanding the question, because the civil rights protests should have been allowed to go forward as long as they
should have
peaceful.
Been, but you were saying that you were bringing the UC Berkeley thing as where that's what you're presenting as, like, where it began from your memory. But I was just thinking of videos where you see where the frickin' fire hoses are out there pushing protesters around. But then there's a movie called A Time to Kill where, you know, some Southern boys, they decide to just do terrible, terrible things to a little girl walking home from school who happens to be a different color skin than they are.
Well, now, I did live through that era of the civil rights protests.
I know you
did. We're kind of comparing a different thing. Being in the streets protesting, and some did get violent. Most of them didn't, to my recollection, at least in the part of the country I was in, and I was also quite young. We didn't have any real violence in my town, but they did protest, and they chanted, "We shall overcome," and all that kind of stuff. But that's a different thing than what we have. We were having our own event in a paid venue
Yeah.
That we had a contractual obligation to be allowed to have our event. And these people did not want us to assemble. I don't think anybody, I don't think very many people minded the civil rights people protesting. The contingent was that they were getting out of hand and they were breaking the laws and doing stuff. And there are always going to be agitators in a group of protesters. There are always going to be people who do stupid stuff. But that doesn't represent the entire group. That represents one or two fringe people that act inappropriately. But we were in our own venue that we had paid for or were about to pay for.
So where does this then cross the line of it being a First Amendment breach? Because this is we are a private entity. The Proud Boys are, for whatever term you want to call them, an entity. They are, you know, this isn't a government organization. And then the hotel is a private entity. So how is this like a free speech issue?
Well, I don't know that it is a free speech issue in the sense of the Constitution protecting. I'm just saying, as a people, this is who we've been as America. We respect divergent views, or at least we used to. Why is it that we all of a sudden don't respect that the group of people that were assembling in Grand Rapids wanted to have redress of their grievances, and they wanted to talk about their grievances, and they wanted to present a plan to address their grievances? That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that the government didn't do anything. I mean, directly, the government may have suggested to the hotel that they cancel, the government being law enforcement. But it wasn't the government shutting us down. It was people who don't believe that there should be a free exchange of ideas, like in Berkeley in 1983. The students magically didn't believe there should be a free exchange of ideas when there were ideas that they didn't agree with.
Well, so in my understanding of the world, the Proud Boys, from my point of view, they should be listed as a terrorist organization. But however, only Canada and New Zealand have done that. So why doesn't the U.S. label them that way?
Well, as I understand it, U.S. law only lets the State Department designate foreign groups as foreign terrorist organizations. Under Section 219 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, because the Proud Boys are a domestic network, they fall outside of that statute. To blacklist a U.S.-based group, Congress would have to pass new legislation, something that has never managed to be done due to the First Amendment and due process concerns.
So then, I guess if they're not formally listed, how do foreign agencies track or even like articulate, how do they describe them as whatever they are, that entity?
Well, the FBI and DHS slot them under an umbrella of threat categories, usually militia or anti-government extremists, and internal bulletins named the Proud Boys specifically. But that wording guides investigators only. It carries no legal penalties. You can be an extremist group, but you have to actually act on your extremism before you've broken the law.
Do you know if there's any hard evidence that would link the Proud Boys to events that might get them charged with illegal activities, like, I don't know, like January 6th?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I'm told that encrypted chats on Telegram called Ministry of Self-Defense laid out a plan, phone data, placed their teams at the first barricade breach back at the Capitol on January 6th, and a video showed member Dominic Pizzola smashing the first window. Those facts convinced a jury to convict those five leaders of seditious conspiracy back in 2023.
Now, what, so like, you know, NARSTAL is a 501c4, I guess they are, and then its sister organization is a 501c3. The affiliates are groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center is an actual group. So what are the Proud Boys? Are they a real organization on paper, like a nonprofit? Are you in a political PAC or something like that?
Well, just be correct. NARSTAL does have a C3 for its foundation, but no, they're a loose fraternity chapters, as I understand it. They've filled a few shell LLCs. They filed them for merchandise and legal defense, but there's no, to my knowledge, IRS recognition of a charitable, no PAC filings or anything that we've been able to unearth with our vast research arm here at FYP Education.
Have they been able to get any like high level operatives, whatever, do they end up at the higher ends of having political context, do you think?
Well, possibly, both symbolically and personally. Do you recall during the debates of 2016, one of the candidates was directly asked about denouncing hate groups?
I do recall that.
The reply was, the reply after pushing was stand back and stand by. And this became their rallying cry. It was the West Wing doorway right outside the Oval Office corridor, the spot tourists sometimes pass on White House holiday tour, but never into the Oval Office itself. And I can't pronounce that. What's that? Tarrio's own?
Tarrio.
Tarrio's
Enrique
own,
Tarrio.
Parlor posts showed him in that West Wing area, and the White House told reporters he'd simply been on a public Christmas tour, not in a meeting. Roger Stone and Michael Flynn used Proud Boys members as informal security, and late December social media blast, "Be there, we'll be wild," served as a catalyst for their January 6, 2021 mobilization.
That was poorly written by me, but that was there's a photo posting on his Parler account, and Parler is it's Truth Social before Truth Social was a thing, and there was a photo of him posted standing near the Oval Office, but he says that he was just there on a tour, not like being invited. So then it seems that the current administration pardoned all of them in 2025. Did that have any kind of practical effect on their their psyche as an organization, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I'm going to deviate from the script. Let's just imagine this. If you've ever been in prison, I don't know if you have or haven't, but if you've ever been in prison, can you imagine if they walked in one day and said, "You guys are free to go. Whatever you did, whatever put you here, it wasn't all that bad. Go ahead, go home, party it up." It erased long prison sentences for nearly every top Proud Boy. Extremism and analysts say that remove deterrence, and I would agree with that. If you let the prisoners go and say, "Be good boys, we forgive you," after you've been in prison for a week and a half, it probably wouldn't have much deterrent effect. But within weeks, release leaders were back on the street raising money and vowing political work for the administration. DHS's 2025 threat memo still ranks militia extremists, including Proud Boys, as a lethal danger.
Now, some supporters claim that the government singled them out for a harsh treatment. Do you think that there is merit to support that?
No, I don't. I mean, yes, I've heard that. But it's amazing to me. Remember, we just went through in an earlier segment about the 1984 Sentencing Reform Act, where they abolished parole, where they abolished all but 54 days a year, which is about 15% good time. And they put these sentencing guidelines. The very same people that enacted that legislation, many of them are already not in office, but the same philosophical approach to being tough on crime, magically they did a flip-flop. They magically said that there should be no pretrial detention. They got mad that these people were held without bond, which they abolished as part of the Sentencing Reform Act, made it very difficult for people that are facing federal charges to be released. And so I don't believe it was single. I believe it was our system as it was designed to work by the very people who are complaining about it today. But they were certainly high profile, about 5% of the roughly 1,500 January 6 defendants. But they weren't alone. The Oath Keepers faced the same rare seditious conspiracy charge. Prosecutors argued the Proud Boys got tougher counts. That should be protesters, but got tougher counts, I guess, because they planned the breach and supplied the first violence, and not because of selective prosecution. Now, this is coming from the same administration who said that he's going to order the U.S. Attorney General to seek maximum penalties. You remember that?
I do recall this.
Now, magically, he's against maximum penalties, and his supporters don't ask him to square that. That always surprises me. You're either for maximum penalties or you're not. You're for top charges for the most serious crime that can be filed or you're not. But magically, he's done a flip-flop and nobody's noticed it.
I stole a comment from someone, but I'm going to leave them anonymous to this. And there's some interesting things that this individual had to say, and says, "In our present generation, there's a growing propensity in the use of unsupportable, false allegations used against the innocent and used against those who are hurting and earnestly seeking answers, support, and direction. So often, a false allegation coupled with name-calling and degrading labels upstages and buries the truth. Our forefathers sacrificed everything to guarantee that the generations that followed them would live in a land where the freedom of speech and the right to assemble peacefully would remain as immovable as pillars in American society. Yet, there are those who obviously never learned and have refused to embrace these core principles that were originally sewn into the fabric of this nation. They resort to name-calling, malign character, breeding misinformation, intimidating, fear-mongering, threats, and violence. They are nothing but a grade school playground bullies who never grew up. They have no positive motivation or cause. They exist solely to intimidate and harm others. I've just now been doing some preliminary research on what qualifies a group or organization to be classified as a domestic terrorist organization. Though this term is used frequently, there does not seem to be much legal precedent. Most laws seem to apply to a foreign terrorist organization. I can hope that these initial findings are premature. So, does NARSAL need to acquire access to a private island in order to practice their constitutional right to assemble peacefully? Lawsuits take years. Someone with authority clearly needs to intervene.
Well, not so much about the private island. My goodness, where would you put it? How would you find, if there was a million PFRs and you extend out to their families, that would be millions more because you'd have usually a significant other and possibly children. So you're talking about millions of people. What island would we put millions of people on?
We should take over Puerto Rico.
I think you're talking now, or maybe Greenland.
Oh, yeah, that's a large area, and we are already in like the talks to take them over. Perfect.
Or Iceland.
I don't have anything else, Larry. Iceland? Well, yeah, but it's cold in Greenland for sure. It's mostly ice. There's like only 50,000 people in Greenland, I think.
So, well, I don't know. I think that I saw a person from the executive branch of NARSAL. If that person would like the mic open to say a few words, I wouldn't mind that happening. It's kind of impromptu, but I know I'm really irritated, and I suspect, I mean, I'm trying to be very circumspect because this is very difficult situation and their possible legal ramifications that will unfold. But it is so demoralizing that all the work we put into it and tens of thousands of dollars of labor hours and hard costs are down the drain.
Definitely the labor hours. I got a whole bunch of camera gear here sitting in my room that I've been practicing to do this conference. Tons and tons and tons. I'm waiting to see if... Do you want to come on the air for a moment to talk at all?
So,
I'm asking if she wants to. Sure. So. All right. Well, then you are unmuted. Hi, Brenda. How are you?
Hello.
Oh, my God.
Let's give her a proper introduction so the audience knows who they're hearing from.
Well, Brenda, who are you?
That's a good question. I've kind of lost track this week. Last time I checked, though, I think my name is Brenda Jones, and I'm executive director of NARSAL.
I think that'll do it.
So is there anything that you feel comfortable in sharing about this unfolding saga of the conference being canceled, or is it too early to say anything beyond what we've said, which I tried to be very limited in the script?
The only thing I think I'm comfortable saying extra at this point is that for those people who did sign up to attend, and, you know, we're all dealing with major stress, crankiness, whatever, over all of that. We are, a few of us are working on a more like a support community event this coming Saturday afternoon. It'll just be a Zoom meeting. It's not a replacement for the conference. That's going to come later, and it's going to be live, dang it. And but it is an opportunity for folks to get together, maybe vent a little bit, and maybe have a chance to calm down, too, find a way to calm down. Anyway, we're still working on that. But if you did sign up to attend and would appreciate that opportunity to at least meet together in community, we are working on that, making some progress on that.
May I ask a question?
Of course.
I have seen lots of gripes from people, both on connections and in some other places, where they didn't get notified and it's not on the website. And I completely am in support of the NARSAL position of keeping a low profile and only notifying those that seem necessary. And, but... So the other side of that would be transparency, openness. Mm-hmm. I realize everyone is incredibly busy trying to figure out where their tail is and running around in circles. So what can you share about that?
What I can say about that is that everyone who signed up to attend either in person or virtually should have gotten an email. Now, I've heard in a few instances where a message ended up in spam.
Sure.
We found a handful of people that somehow or other had actually turned off getting emails in the system. So that right. They'd already said, do not email me. So they didn't get it. And yeah, so we definitely are aware of a few people who should have gotten it and didn't. But everybody who signed up should have. And my apologies if there are still people out there who never got one. But yeah, and we're going to continue trying to reach out to the people who haven't responded, because what we did send out included a form to fill out to say, you know, this is how I was impacted. Yes, I want to get a refund. I'm having trouble getting a refund on my plane tickets, you know, stuff like that. We actually have a little form like that because we're trying to collect that data and help people where we can.
Gotcha. So okay.
I would just add that in that regard, if you didn't get that, if you missed it somehow, conference@narsal.org will get to the people who need to get it. So.
Very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Yes, we're sending out a lot of notices. We are really are trying to make contact with everyone. We're going to inevitably have one or two people show up at the conference not knowing it's been canceled. That's just the way life unfolds. But if you don't check your emails regularly, if you don't check your spam folder regularly, it's like we're text messaging. We're doing everything that we have the capacity to do. Stuff I didn't even know we had the capacity to do. We're doing trying to get forward to everybody. I didn't know.
Yeah, one of our affiliates had an ability to do that and loaned us that account because we didn't have one set up directly.
So, but we're definitely trying to let people know. We don't want you to show up at a conference.
No,
it's not going to occur. So,
mm-hmm.
So, all righty. Well. Appreciate
you. I don't have anything else.
All right. Well, then we shut this thing down.
Thank you, Brenda. I really appreciate it. And I hope you're getting sleep.
I am doing my best to do so.
Yes.
There were some days where things are slowing down a little now.
All righty then. Well, head over to registrymatters.co to check up on some show notes. Did I mention that Eric and Brian became patrons? Like, and this would be like a month ago now? I think I keep forgetting to mention these cats.
I don't remember them being mentioned, no.
All right. Well, now they've been mentioned. They have their 10 seconds of fame. So as I said, registrymatters.co for show notes, and you can listen to the podcast there on that website if you'd like. You can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. If you happen to know other people going to the conference, please tell them if they don't already know. Find out if they do know that it has been canceled that way. It would be great if nobody showed up, Larry, because that would really suck for you to show up on Thursday or Friday and they're like, dunk, 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 dunk. Hey, I'm here for the conference. Sorry, no conference. Go home. Sorry. That would suck.
Indeed.
747-227-4477 is the phone number. I hope I didn't say too many sevens. And then, of course, patreon.com/registrymatters makes all of this possible. They are our co-creators and producers of this show, so to speak. And without anything else, I hope everyone has a fantabulous evening. And Larry, stay cool, hydrate, and keep them swamp coolers running.
Sounds good. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.